Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome to everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Bladder Cancer Treatment Updates. And this workshop is done in partnership with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. We want to thank them for their partnership today, and you'll be hearing more from them later on in the workshop. And this activity is supported by an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson. We really want to thank them for the support of today's program. Now, to start, I just want to let you all know how many people we have on the call. We have over 150 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Argentina, Canada, Colombia, and Taiwan. So it is a global call. We're delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Corinne Tawaji. And Dr. Tawaji is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Genitourinary Oncology at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And Dr. Tawaji will be discussing updates on clinical trials, how research increased treatment options, targeted treatments predicting response to treatment, as well as the role of immunotherapy. Now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Tawaji.
Thank you so much for the introduction. So I'm going to dive into some of the topics that were assigned to me to discuss. So first, I was asked to talk about clinical trials, and clinical trials are the essential pathway through which every cancer treatment that we have available now has become available. So there isn't any drug or device or treatment strategy that can become a standard option without first being tested and proven to be effective through clinical trials. And so the only way that we can advance cancer care is through clinical trials. And for patients enrolled in clinical trials, there is the benefits potentially of having early access to promising therapies. So many new drugs that eventually become approved can be available through clinical trials. So for example, in metastatic bladder cancer, we have two drugs that have been approved for the last 3 years called enfortumab or PADCEV and pembrolizumab or Keytruda. And the reason that that was eventually approved and shown to be superior to chemotherapy was through a clinical trial. And so this is incredibly important. And, I think the next thing is that in bladder cancer, we're increasingly moving towards personalized medicine. And so clinical trials are increasingly using what we call biomarkers, or think of it as if your cancer expresses a specific flag that we can use treatment to directly attack that flag on your specific cancer, then we can match patients with treatments that are more likely to work for their specific cancer biology. And so in different types of bladder cancer, but at this point in metastatic bladder cancer, we have a flag called FGFR, and now we have chemo pills that can directly affect that flag for patients that have cancer that expresses that flag, the FGFR. And so, we have different clinical trials that are increasingly looking at personalized medicine. So looking at, for each patient's individual cancer, are they expressing any specific tumors or flags that can be targeted more directly? In addition, clinical trials can look at new types of drug delivery. So for example, for patients with localized early stage bladder cancer, when it's just in the bladder and it's called non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, we have new devices called pretzel devices that basically are little devices put into the bladder that will release chemotherapy over over a few days. And so this is another way that clinical trials are bringing these new treatments and new modes of deliveries to improve patient care overall. And also, we don't just test if clinical trials work well, but we also check to see if they're safe and if quality of life is impacted significantly. And so clinical trials don't just test whether treatments work, they also evaluate whether these newer treatments are better tolerated. And so we always look to see, is there a risk-benefit trade-off of newer treatments with side effects, with quality of life? Or should I just go on to the next section, or are there any questions with regards to clinical trials specifically?
Yeah, you can do the presentation, and then at the end we'll do the Q&A, you can just go straight through.
Perfect. Okay. So just a little bit more on clinical trials. There are different phases of clinical trials. So phase one, phase two, phase three, those are most commonly what you'll see. Not for any patients to really necessarily need to know the difference between all of them, but phase one usually will establish the safe dosing in a smaller number of patients. Phase two trials will look at whether there's meaningful anti-cancer activity. And then phase three trials will compare the current standard of care to a newer treatment, which we suspect could be better and potentially change practice. And so all participants receive at least the current standard of care. Nobody receives an effective treatment when one already exists. And so really the current standard of care that exists for bladder cancer, including immunotherapy, which I'll talk about, targeted therapies, which I mentioned in terms of giving more precise treatments, and then a new class of drugs called antibody drug conjugates, which essentially is like a missile that will deliver chemo into the cancer cell. These are all approved as a result of clinical trials. And so continued participation is essential so that we can continue to improve outcomes in bladder cancer, reduce side effects, and also develop more personalized treatment strategies for patients living with bladder cancer. I've talked about some of the biomarkers or targeted treatments, and so some of the key advances in addition in biomarker testing, I mentioned FGFR is one of them that has been approved in metastatic bladder cancer or stage 4 bladder cancer, so when the cancer spreads from where it started to other sites. HER2 is another marker that we look for as far as targeted treatments. And then another promising biomarker is called ctDNA, which is circulating tumor DNA. And basically, it's a blood test that detects tiny fragments of tumor DNA circulating in the blood. And so there are increasingly different clinical trials looking at this blood test to see if it can predict the response to the treatment, predict if the cancer is coming back, and things of the sort. And then I want to mention the role of immunotherapy. So immunotherapy has essentially changed the landscape of bladder cancer. So from early stage bladder cancer to more advanced stages of bladder cancer, immunotherapy is approved in every setting. So how immunotherapy works is that basically it's using a patient's own immune system to fight off the cancer cells. So if you think of chemotherapy as, the older treatment that patients with cancer were getting, a few decades ago that just killed rapidly dividing cells, and it still is effective in many cancer types and settings, but immunotherapy works in a different way. So if you think of your body as when you have a virus or bacteria fighting off that infection with your immune system, the way that immunotherapy works is it basically makes your immune system recognize the cancer cells as foreign and uses your own immune system to fight off the cancer in that way. And so there are side effects as a result of using the immune system, which are called immune-related adverse events. So for patients that are receiving immunotherapy, anything out of the ordinary, we want you to let your care team know. But immunotherapy is approved in every disease stage in bladder cancer. So chances are if you have bladder cancer, either that is at this point in time, muscle invasive bladder cancer or metastatic bladder cancer, that you'll be offered immunotherapy as part of your treatment. It also is sometimes used in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, so the early stage of bladder cancer that's just in that inner layer of the bladder. But really, immunotherapy is the standard of care now in muscle-invasive bladder cancer, both before and after surgery, known as cystectomy, to remove the bladder. It's also approved in metastatic bladder cancer or stage 4 bladder cancer as the preferred frontline treatment. So it's, in this case, it's pembrolizumab or Keytruda, generally given with Padcev or enfortumab. But there are some patients for which immunotherapy maybe isn't the best treatment, and those could be patients with a history of an organ transplant, a history of an uncontrolled autoimmune disease. But if not, we generally use immunotherapy in all of these disease sites. And there are tons of clinical trials looking at immunotherapy in additional settings as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions on any of those topics so far.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Tawaji. I actually have one question for you. So for immunotherapy and looking for our, in terms of adverse effects of immunotherapy, what monitoring is done by the team aside from having the patient self-report? Is there any sort of, what does that checkup look like?
That's a great question. So basically, before starting immunotherapy, we'll do a comprehensive checklist of knowing, you know, making sure the patient doesn't have any history of autoimmune disease or organ transplant, and then finding out, you know, what's their baseline in terms of number of stools a day, things like that. So we will check blood work before every round to check for liver function, kidney function, thyroid levels, to make sure that there isn't any issue as far as immune-related adverse events on blood work, because sometimes those can present on blood work alone. But otherwise, we really have to be comprehensive in terms of educating patients to self-report things like diarrhea, things like new shortness of breath or cough, things like, you know, pain in a place that they didn't have pain before. So those are all some of the things. And then rash, itching, those are all things that we will definitely rely on the patients to self-report. But otherwise, it's really blood work and a visit, you know, before every treatment to find out if there's any concern for any immune adverse events.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for answering our question. I'm going to introduce our second speaker. And our second speaker is Dr. Arnav Basu. And Dr. Basu is medical oncologist, genitourinary oncology, senior associate consultant at Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center in Jacksonville, Florida. And Dr. Basu will be discussing an overview of bladder cancer, including staging and grading, standard of care, as well as new treatment approaches. Now going to hand it over to Dr. Basu.
Thank you so much, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you to the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and Cancer Care for the opportunity to speak today. My goal over the next few minutes is to provide a patient-friendly overview of bladder cancer, what it is, how we stage it, grade it, what the current standard treatments are, and where the field is moving with newer therapies and research. So let's start with the basics. The bladder is a hollow organ in the pelvis that stores urine. The inner lining of the bladder is made of cells called urothelial cells or transitional cells. As the number of cells can slide on top of each other as the bladder expands or contracts, so they transition from more layers to less. Most bladder cancers arise from this lining. Because of this, bladder cancer is often called urothelial carcinoma or transitional cell carcinoma. Sometimes due to local irritation or other factors, there can be a change in the transitional cells to other abnormal type of cells like squamous cells or glandular cells, and these are called variants. These may be mixed in with the transitional cells, or the cancer may be purely a variant cancer. Bladder cancer presents along a wide clinical spectrum. In clinical practice, most bladder cancers are relatively superficial and slow growing. Others can be aggressive and capable of spreading to lymph nodes or distant organs. Understanding exactly where the cancer is located and how aggressive it appears is critical because it determines treatment recommendations. So that brings us to two important concepts, grading and staging. Grading refers to how abnormal the cancer cells look when you see them under a microscope. And generally, we classify bladder tumors as either high grade or low grade. And this is particularly relevant in a non-muscle invasive space, which we will talk about later. Low-grade cancers tend to grow slowly and are less likely to invade into the bladder wall and therefore spread elsewhere. High-grade cancers are the opposite. They have a higher risk of invading into the muscle and extravesicular spread. So moving on from grading, let's talk about staging. Staging really refers to how far the cancer has spread. And the almost universal system used for cancer staging is called the TNM system, with T standing for tumor characteristics, N for nodal characteristics or nodal involvement, and M for metastatic involvement. The earliest stages of bladder cancer are non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. In this situation, the cancer is limited to the inner lining or connective tissue layers of the bladder, but has not invaded into the bladder muscle itself. That muscle is also called the muscularis. The layer is called the muscularis propria. You might see that on a pathology report. So these non-muscle invasive bladder cancers are staged, are given T stages of TA, T1, and there's another special stage called TCIS, also known as carcinoma in situ. Carcinoma in situ is especially important because it is a flat kind of a bladder cancer that hasn't invaded into the muscle, but it spreads along the layers of the bladder, and so it sometimes is not very visible, but it can still be very aggressive. So moving on from non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, the muscle wall of the bladder is a strong barrier to the spread of cancer. So when the cancer grows into the muscle wall, it is called muscle invasive bladder cancer and often abbreviated as MIBC. This is quite serious because once the cancer reaches the muscle layer, the risk is there's a high risk for it to kind of move out of the bladder. And this is called a T2 stage. If the cancer moves beyond the bladder to the lymph nodes, it becomes a stage 3, and then it moves outside to another organ, then it's called metastatic bladder cancer or stage 4. So moving on to how we diagnose and manage bladder cancer. As you would imagine, you know, this is a tumor that's inside the bladder, so you'd have to go inside in order to sample it. That process to do that is called a TURBT, or transurethral resection of the bladder tumor. This is done during a procedure called a cystoscopy, where the urologist goes in with a flexible instrument, looks inside the bladder, and then scrapes the tumor out. During this time, the urologist takes special attention in order to get a little bit of the muscle that's underlying the tumor in order to assess the muscle invasion of the tumor. This tissue is then examined by the pathologist to determine the grade and depth of invasion. This helps us understand where the cancer is inside the bladder, but we also need to find out what's going on outside. So typically you would order CT scans, CT urograms in particular. Otherwise, MRI scans and PET scans are also used sometimes to determine if the cancer has spread outside. There are also some novel blood tests that Dr. Tawaji kind of mentioned before that can look for a signature of the cancer in the blood and can be further help to stratify the risk. So now that we talked a little bit about the diagnosis and staging, let's talk about some standard treatment approaches. For non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, which are much lower risk as we talked about, treatment usually begins with a TURBT to remove the visible tumor. After this surgery, many patients receive medication placed directly into the bladder called intravesicular therapy. And one of the most common intravesicular treatments is BCG, which stands for Bacillus Calmette-Guérin. It's actually a weakened bacterium that we introduce into the bladder. It has no pathogenic ability by itself, but it just stimulates the immune system inside the bladder. And then it wakes up and then it sees cancer cells and hopefully attacks it. This was perhaps one of our earliest immunotherapies. We didn't know much about our modern approaches. And it has been a cornerstone of bladder cancer management for decades and remains very effective. Some patients may not respond to BCG and their cancer can return. And in those cases, there are several options, including bladder removal surgery, but increasingly we are using other bladder sparing options, such as new immunotherapy approaches and gene therapy-based treatments. So moving on from non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, when we talked about this before, with a muscle invasion, the risk of cancer spreading outside the bladder goes up significantly. So for this reason, we actually recommend some therapy before the bladder is removed, even though we cannot see anything. And the idea is to mop up some amount of cancer that might be floating around and then taking care of the bladder where it came from. Studies have shown that giving chemotherapy and now novel therapy before surgery improves survival for eligible patients. After bladder removal, urine must be diverted from the body to another pathway. Some patients can have a bag placed outside where it drains, and some patients may get other procedures like a neobladder, which creates a new bladder. Another important point is that not every patient may need or want the bladder removal surgery. In those patients, there's an approach called trimodal therapy, which combines maximum tumor resection, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy together. The goal is to treat the cancer aggressively while preserving the bladder. There have been a lot of very exciting new developments in the treatment of muscle-invasive bladder cancer, particularly with the use of immunotherapy and the use of an antibody drug conjugate called enfortumab vedotin, which Dr. Tawagi referenced earlier. Historically, we had used chemotherapy as the primary treatment option before these came along. As Dr. Tawagi kind of mentioned before, the immunotherapy drugs kind of wake up your body's immune system by targeting these, blocking these receptors called PD-1 and PD-L1 that the tumors use to hide from the immune system. And we are now combining it with these new category of drugs called antibody drug conjugates, which are really a very potent chemotherapy, but it's got a lock and key system, and the key really just supposed to go just into the bladder cancer cells. So combining these two approaches with immunopembrolizumab and enfortumab vedotin, we are seeing that almost at the time of surgery, even a large majority of patients, 60%, 50% of patients, do not have any residual cancer left at the time of surgery after receiving some of these in the neoadjuvant setting. Another exciting area of research is the use of circulating tumor DNA, which also Dr. Tawagi mentioned before. This is a signature that is developed from sequencing the tumor at the time of the QRBT, and it is like looking at your blood with a microscope trying to find even one or two molecules of the cancer floating around. And this is becoming very relevant for patients, particularly who have completed surgery and may be at high risk for the cancer coming back. There are a lot of new clinical trials that are looking at immunotherapies and other agents in this setting. Moving on to metastatic disease, these targeted therapies and immunotherapies, antibody drug conjugates, have improved the standard of care immensely, in some cases doubling and tripling survival for patients with advanced disease. Also, Dr. Tawagi mentioned, you know, some of the markers like FGFR and HER2, which we are now finding through gene sequencing and staining on tumors that can be targeted with new generation molecules. And also, given the effectiveness of our treatments, there's a lot of growing interest in improving bladder preservation strategies. So researchers are trying to identify which patients can safely avoid bladder removal and instead receive combinations of chemotherapy, radiation, targeted therapies, or now new intravesicular devices. Importantly, survivorship and quality of life are now recognized as central parts of bladder cancer care, and we are trying to improve outcomes so more patients can live more fulfilling and meaningful lives. Thank you very much for your attention, and thank you for all the work that all of you patients, caregivers, and advocates are doing to improve outcomes for patients living with bladder cancer. Thank you. And I'll open it for
questions. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Basu. And our next speaker is Dr. Stephanie Berg. And Dr. Berg is instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, genitourinary oncologist, the Lank Center for Genitourinary Oncology at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Berg will be discussing communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns, follow-up care appointments and plans, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth / telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. Now going to turn this program over to Dr. Berg.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for that kind introduction. What a wonderful event that we're having here today. It's speaking and to all of you, and I've heard such wonderful topics discussed about bladder cancer. So my talk right now over the next few minutes is a little bit different and more about how we can communicate about quality of life, how you can follow up, and about telemedicine, which is something that we, you know, do hear a lot in the United States ever since, especially since the COVID pandemic. And what I would like to emphasize is that bladder cancer care is not only about test results. It's really about how you feel and function in everyday life. And I want to emphasize that many people that are living with or, you know, if they've had bladder cancer treatment, you can still have concerns during your treatment or after your treatment with urinary or bowel changes, fatigue, pain or discomfort, sexual health concerns, body image concerns, emotional distress, work, family, travel, or financial distress. And then, you know, if you had a procedure to remove your bladder, questions about your reconstructed bladder or, you know, the ileal conduit, or we call that a urinary diversion. And what I tell my patients is, when you can talk to your care team, is really outline what is happening. Try to really be specific with them. Say things like, I'm worried about leakage. I'm having skin irritation around my stoma. I'm feeling anxious before every scan. I'm too tired to do my usual activities. That we really appreciate about, instead of just saying, I'm okay, because it really does help us really understand the best communication pathways and how we can help. So we also recommend from Dana-Farber a notebook or even, on your phone. We all have, you know, powerful computers that we carry around in our pockets. If you have symptoms, record it. When do they happen? What makes them better for or worse? Show your providers. You have a calendar app on your phone. Write it down. Show us. It really does make a difference. And remember that your healthcare team isn't just a medical oncologist. It's also your urologist, your nurse, your primary care clinician. There's an ostomy nurse. There's a social worker. We have physical therapy, occupational therapy, mental health, sexual health specialist, nutrition. So all of these people are involved in your care. And, you know, usually your medical oncology team is kind of the quarterback, we say, using an American reference to help navigate all of this, but it is really important that the appropriate team members are involved based on what you can describe as happening. What I can tell you about follow-up care appointments and plans is that it's really important that if you've had bladder cancer treatment or you're getting treatment for bladder cancer, that even after the treatment ends, care continues, and it obviously is very important during your treatment to, you know, you're going to be coming to the office a lot. You're going to be getting infusions. You're having physical exams. You're having imaging. You're having testing. You're having cystoscopies, which were described earlier. And, of course, a lot of monitoring, a lot of questions are going to be asked of you. So it really does depend on your personal situation and what treatment you've had. But, it could be different for someone who had bladder-sparing treatment. They could be having a different routine than someone who had surgery to remove the bladder. Or if you're, you know, living with if you're getting bladder cancer treatment all the time, that means, you know, about your side effects and how we can change things to make you feel better. Do we have to adjust your doses? Do we have to give you a different treatment? And also how you can manage after having a neobladder or ileal conduit, things like that. So that's really important that you have those appropriate appointments during your care. A good follow-up plan will really outline which doctor you need to see and when. You don't need to perhaps see your urologist perhaps as much after you're done compared to medical oncology or vice versa, what tests you are expected to have during your visit, what symptoms that are important to really have you call in the office, or, you know, if you have electronic medical records, sending in a message, which medicines or supplies that you may need, and how we can also communicate with your primary care team or other providers for your health, like, you know, your heart doctor, your stomach doctor, your endocrine diabetes doctor, to make sure that everybody is communicating well and we're all on the same page. We always ask patients, you know, through your patient portal, you could always ask them, what is my follow-up schedule? Who do I call if I have problems? Do I call if it's not during the normal office hours? Who do I call? Is my doctor on call? Is it going to be another doctor or somebody else? You know, what are the late effects that I should expect? Where do I get my supplies if you have an ileal conduit? Who will manage it? Do I have a nurse, like an ostomy nurse? Or who do I reach out to? So these are really important to keep your team members involved. And lastly, for telehealth or telemedicine, as we also say, because, you know, we can do these via phone calls like we're on today, or it could be through a video visit that you could have with your provider, especially if you live far away and it's not as easy for you to come back and forth in the clinic. As I always say, make sure when you have the technology ready, what you're using. Are you using your home phone, your cell phone? Are you using your home computer? Are you using your smartphone, and making sure that it's charged, that you have the right connection, that you can log on right away? I know there's a lot of issues. I can tell you that it is, for us as providers, we book our telemedicine or telehealth appointments during our regular clinic. And, you know, we're seeing patients in real time and on the web. So I would always say be patient with your provider, because they might not log on right away because they had an overflow from another patient that they were seeing in person, but they will get to your call eventually, because as we know, providers, we always run a little bit behind schedule. So just keep that in mind. If they're not logging in exactly at 8 a.m., there maybe was a 7:30 patient that just needed some more assistance, and so they will get to you eventually, or they will give you the call. Also, make sure you have a strong internet connection. And, of course, if you aren't able to make the call yourself, is to just let us know that you're not going to be available at that time to come on the call. Make sure that you have, you know, that you're in a quiet room, that we can hear each other very clearly, and then really have your information ready. What medicines you're taking, you know, any recent symptoms. Like I said before, be specific. Vital signs, you know, your team might ask you to take your blood pressure that day, or they might ask you what your weight is, a list of your supplies, or, you know, any devices that you are using, or what issues you've come up with, and any other questions or any other concerns that you have that you want to talk about during the visit. So, I really do love the notebook idea, or using your smartphone idea, to be prepared, because, again, as clinicians, we look through your chart, we kind of know what we want to talk about, but I think when both parties have a good idea of what can be addressed, you're going to have a very fruitful and meaningful visit with your provider. The other thing is for telemedicine, you could ask, like, maybe your doctor never offered you to have telemedicine, but you should ask, do I need to come in person? If I'm only being seen every 6 months, do you need to see me, or can we do a virtual call? Is that okay? And that's something that's important, too. Or, you know, you just want to come by and say hi to everyone. That's all right, too. And then the last thing about open notes. So open notes is a term that, where in electronic medical record systems, all patients are allowed to see what their visit notes look like, and there's usually a portal that is linked to what you can read about what the provider discussed. And it's really also helpful not only in bladder cancer survivorship or if you're on therapy, but you can look in there, read what was discussed. You can double-check the plan. You can share more information with your team and really be prepared next time. You can say things like, I read your note, I would like clarifications about this, or I don't understand these terms. As providers, sometimes we use medical jargon, and you just might not know what we're talking about. So please, you know, reach out to us and our teams to really clarify this, because this is in your medical record. Or something like, well, this I read, it doesn't really match what I thought we talked about. And so it's something that really should support clear communication, but it's not going to replace it. So it's more about reviewing that, having that opportunity, and then asking questions afterwards if you need more clarity. So I hope that really helps. And my take-home messages are, really speak up with specific questions about your quality of life. We know we want you to all be okay, but we know that okay doesn't help us in a lot of things if there's a lot of things going on. Really do know what your follow-up plan is and who to contact. I find that the most important. There's so many of us that participate in your care. It usually is through your doctor, but we're not available all the time. You know, we could be out. There could be somebody covering from us. You know, our nurses, our physician's assistants, nurse practitioners. You know, if we work in large academic centers, we have trainees that work with us. So that, I think, is really important to know, like, who to call, where I get my care, instead of always just, you know, obviously if it's an emergency, we're going to tell you to go to the emergency room, but, I mean, we can, you know, that's for another time. And then really, you know, if you do have telehealth, ask if you can be using telehealth. It can be really helpful for quality of life that you don't have to sit. I mean, I practice up here in Boston, and I treat a lot of men and women in Western Massachusetts and Maine and Vermont, and I get it. You know, nobody wants to drive into the city and sit in hours of traffic when we can do some local care. So ask and then look at your notes and have questions and be prepared. I think that's been really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berg. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. I'm now going to pass it over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in providing you the energy to do the things that you want to do for your day-to-day activities, but also in your tolerance to treatment. Your diet might be modified, maybe before, during, or even after your cancer treatment, mainly to assist with any side effects you might be experiencing. And so meeting with a dietitian is very, very important. I think a lot of patients forget that a dietitian is part of their healthcare team, but meeting with a dietitian up front can be helpful just in the beginning to kind of establish where you are with your nutrition needs, and then, of course, being able to maintain a follow-up. Some potential side effects you could experience are things that include things like mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, maybe changes in taste or smell, potentially nausea or vomiting, and changes in appetite. A dietitian can help with modifying your diet to help you meet your nutrition goals in the presence of these side effects. Now, a lot of times when you're going through cancer treatment, it's a lot of information up front, specifically when it comes to medications and side effects and things like that. Doctors will provide medication to address these side effects. Sometimes it can feel a little overwhelming. You may not need them right away or remember how to use them. So always having a second set of ears with you at an appointment is very helpful. And then as things come up throughout your cancer journey, talking with your healthcare team sooner rather than later so they can help address those. So the dietitian specifically not only helps with the modification of diet based on side effects you may experience, but they also help with providing you some specific goals in survivorship. And a lot of patients were going through treatment, but remember, you're a survivor at the time of diagnosis. And so even though you're not experiencing maybe any side effects, understanding nutrition with cancer is a beneficial component to your care. Now, a lot of times I get patients who are overweight and they feel like, oh, I can lose weight. It's fine. I've got, you know, weight to lose. And while you're going through cancer care, weight changes are something to really keep an eye on. And it has to do a lot with just the way your body uses nutrition while you're going through your cancer journey and the impact of some weight loss. So extreme or significant weight changes are something we want to avoid. They can result in like a loss of lean muscle mass, maybe increasing your risk of fatigue and falls and potentially impacting your treatment journey. So again, talking with your dietitian about your unique needs is very helpful. Now, we talk a lot about food and what we want to do with eating, but remember, hydration is part of our nutrition plan as well. And if you're not eating well, you're probably not drinking well. a general guideline for most patients is need about 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. Now, fluid's anything that's liquid at room temperature, but we want to focus on things that are hydrating. So liquids such as water, milk, juice, those are things that are very hydrating for us. Coffee and caffeinated beverages can oftentimes go the opposite direction, so we just want to be mindful about how much we're consuming of those during treatment. Well, I want to go ahead and conclude my portion of the talk and just encourage all of you to know your healthcare team and to know how to reach out to them and establish a relationship with them as soon as you're able to. I'm going to hand the line back over. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ms. Bearden. And our next speaker is Patricia Rios. And Ms. Rios is Director, Education and Advocacy at Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, who we are partnering with today on this workshop. And I just want to mention again that we're very appreciative to have this partnership on our bladder cancer workshops. BCAN is a great resource for our participants. And Ms. Rios will be discussing BCAN's free programs and services, as well as how to get in contact with them through their support line and website. I'm now going to pass this program over to Ms. Rios.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that introduction and to Cancer Care for putting on this important program and to all of our experts who have been on this call for providing a comprehensive overview of bladder cancer updates and managing and navigating the journey. As was mentioned, my name is Patricia Rios. I am the Director of Education Advocacy for BCAN, also known as the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. And I am going to walk you through some education and support resources that we have for patients and caregivers. For those who are listening and are not familiar with BCAN, I just wanted to share that BCAN is a community united in support of people impacted by bladder cancer. We aim to provide educational and support services, from information about clinical trials to webinars, printed materials, podcasts. We have a treatment matrix, and you can find information about the things I just listed and many more things on our website at bcan.org or bcan.org. For anyone who's looking to speak to someone who has gone through a similar bladder cancer experience, we have a peer-to-peer program called Survivor, which allows us to match individuals, patients and caregivers, with a trained volunteer who can share insight about their own experience with bladder cancer. We know that the bladder cancer journey can feel sometimes isolating and lonely, and so we want to be able to share that patients and caregivers that you're not alone, and we have a community here ready to support you, and our peer-to-peer mentoring program is one of those resources. We also have an in-person summit twice a year that brings together patients and caregivers across the spectrum of the bladder cancer journey, from non-muscle to advanced disease, metastatic disease. And the summits are really an opportunity to see old friends and make new ones while learning from experts in the field. Our next patient summit will be held in San Diego, California on August 28th and 29th, and information about that summit registration is available on our website at bcan.org or bcan.org. I will conclude my section by sharing that in 2023, BCAN partnered with Cancer Care to launch a toll-free support line for bladder cancer patients and caregivers. The support line is staffed by oncology bilingual social workers from Cancer Care who are ready to provide emotional and practical support, as well as to help find various resources that are available on our website and in your community. The support line can be accessed by dialing 833-275-4222, and it is staffed Monday through Thursday between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on Friday between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, that number is 833-275-4222. Thank you so much, and I'll just turn it back to Joni.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rios. And our next speaker is Sarah Tenenhouse. And Ms. Tenenhouse is an oncology social worker as well as our support group program manager here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Tendenhouse will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our helpline and website. I'm going to hand it over to Ms. Tendenhouse.
Thank you. I'm Sarah Tendenhouse, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the support group program manager at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops like this one, publications, and some limited financial assistance. To connect with Cancer Care services, those interested can call Cancer Care's National Hope Line to speak with an oncology social worker or resource navigator at 1-800-813-4673. Cancer Care's resource navigation services are offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. We offer a short-term, strengths-based approach to resource navigation, where the navigator will work with the client to connect them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board and are facilitated by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website, cancercare.org, to join an online support group. Cancer Care's website has a wide array of reading material and information related to bladder cancer. This includes recorded Connect Education workshops, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications, and resources. For further assistance and to access any of our services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Tendenhouse. Okay, and now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you, Bella. And our first question here for Ms. Tendenhouse, who would be best to reach out to regarding help with costs? Paying for treatment has made it difficult for me to budget and pay for my family's essentials.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would first suggest reaching out to your hospital social worker. You may not have met the social worker, but you should certainly inquire as to whether there is a social worker at your treatment center. And they may be able to connect you with local resources and potentially national resources, grants, and other types of assistance. And I would always suggest calling the Cancer Care Hope Line as well for assistance from our social workers, who also might be able to provide you with financial resources and possibly an assistance application if you're eligible to apply for one of our available grants.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Tendenhouse. A question here for Dr. Berg. How do permanent urinary diversions typically work, and will it be done at the same time as my cystectomy?
Yeah, hi. That's a great question. So the most common urinary diversion is a diverting ileal conduit that most people will be recommended versus a neobladder, where it will be done at the same time as the bladder removal surgery with lymph nodes. And then your urologist will reconstruct the by the ureters and create the conduit from a piece of your GI tract called your ileum, which is at the part of your small intestines where the urine can be stored. So you will wake up from your long bladder surgery with that on your body. And what it would consist of, the National Cancer Institute and BCAN have some helpful website images and of what it would be. And clearly, before you go into surgery, you will have a consultation with a ostomy nurse. So they are professionals who teach patients how to manage them, how to you know, with the bag to cover it, to collect the urine. So there is a lot that goes into it before your bladder surgery. But that's, again, not the only way after bladder removal that we divert the urine. You could also have the internal part, which is called the neobladder.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Berg. And another question for you. How often do you monitor B12 with neobladder?
Our national guidelines recommend at least once a year. And the reason for that is because when you remove part of your ileum, which is, can also be constructed in your neobladder or your ileal conduit, your ileum is where your B12 gets absorbed in your small intestines. So typically, if we see deficiencies in B12, we have to do monthly B12 injections. But most people, if it is low, typically below 250 is the level, you can do an oral supplementation of B vitamins. They're very inexpensive. You can purchase at your local pharmacy, but it could also be covered by your insurance to do injections because of the absorption risk, because, again, you're missing part of that piece. But, again, if you take enough, sometimes you can keep your levels okay. But typically we would ask for injections if you're quite deficient. So it should be part of your routine follow-up care is to get a yearly B12 level with blood counts, because a low B12 can cause issues like low hemoglobin, or we say anemia, and can also cause issues with changes in vibration sense in your feet, or we use the word neuropathy. So it's very important that you do have that part of your follow-up care plan after bladder cancer surgery, bladder cancer bladder removal.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berg. And I have a question here for Dr. Basu. So it's mentioned that there are blood and urine tests for detection. Can they be used for prevention?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the tests that we are referring to here are kind of like the signatures of the cancer, and you kind of need the tumor initially in order to kind of even generate that signature. So the current generation of tests we have are more for managing the cancer, seeing if those are going down, or kind of seeing if there's anything left after surgery or other interventions. There is a new generation of cancer tests called MCED, or multi-cancer early detection tests, which may be what you're referring to, kind of like catching the cancer before it even gets to a higher stage. Those are all in clinical trials, and this is a very exciting area of research, but they're not there yet when it comes to intervening on those. But yeah, great question. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Basu. I'm now going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways, just a brief takeaway to conclude. We'll start with Dr. Basu, then Dr. Berg, Ms. Rios, and then Ms. Tenenhaus. So, Dr. Basu?
I think what I would say is there are a lot of exciting treatment options that are coming through for bladder cancer, and had relied on toxic chemotherapy before, and now we are moving to more precise strategies and kind of doing a better risk versus benefit discussions for patients. And stay tuned. I think there's going to be a lot of developments where maybe patients with muscle invasive disease are going to be able to keep their bladders, and patients with advanced disease that have much less toxicity. So it's bright days are ahead for metastatic and localized bladder cancer management.
Thank you very much, Dr. Basu. And Dr. Berg?
I would say and emphasize again that I would want to empower all of our patients to really speak up about quality of life concerns and be specific as possible. Sometimes, though, it's okay to not be specific, but just say that something is wrong is all we need to make sure we can, you know, all meet at the same page. Know your follow-up plan. Who are you going to talk to? Who is going to be your quarterback? Is it, you know, it's usually your doctor, but, you know, there's a lot of, we have so many wonderful people on our care teams that we heard from today, social worker, and you know, everybody. So just make sure you have that person and their team and know who to talk to. And then be prepared. I think we prepare. We want our patients to prepare so we can have very productive visits and, you know, continue your care to the best of our ability. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berg. And Ms. Rios?
Yes, my takeaways will echo some of the things you've already heard, and that falls along with being prepared, asking questions. I think nowadays, and more than ever, it's important to bring someone with you to your appointment. There's a lot of information that's often shared, and could be overwhelming, and so having someone who can help you to take notes, ask questions, it becomes very valuable. And as part of doing your homework, we have a lot of resources on our website to help you help patients, caregivers understand the diagnosis and treatment options. And and that includes some of the things that I mentioned, such as the peer-to-peer matching program. And I'll add that, oftentimes where patients are confronted with making a decision in the radical cystectomy, patients often find it valuable as part of doing their homework, talking to other patients who have lived with those specific types of diversions, right? If it's an Indiana pouch or a neobladder, it'll come to it. So my best, advice would be that there's a lot of information available in schools available to you. Take advantage of them if you need help navigating through all those resources. We are here to assist you.
Thank you, Ms. Rios. And Ms. Tenenhaus?
Yeah, so my takeaway is don't hesitate to self-advocate. If you do need more financial assistance, emotional support, ask about social work services, and take advantage of any available resources like peer matching, and like local programs, small grants, whatever is available to you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tenenhaus. And I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers today. We had a phenomenal panel, covered a lot of different information today. And I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was exceptional because of our speakers and because of our participants from today's program. Now, I do want to say a few words for those of you that asked a question, didn't have a question answered, or you were typing one up in queue. I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your questions. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's workshop. So please take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions again and again. And also, I just want to echo what Dr. Berg had mentioned during her presentation, that it's important to know who to contact on your healthcare team and when, especially on evenings, weekends, and holidays. Now, I want to say I appreciate everyone's participation today on this program. And one last thing is that I don't want anyone to leave this program feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care and at Beacon. As I said, you have a community of support here at Cancer Care and at Beacon. We are here for you. Okay, and I want to wish everyone all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.